This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Darth Bane, Path of Destruction, a novel of the Old Republic, by Drew Karbyshyn. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Prologue. In the last days of the Old Republic, the Sith, followers of the Force's dark side and ancient enemies of the Jedi Order, numbered only two, one master and one apprentice. Yet it was not always so. 1,000 years before the Republic's collapse and Emperor Palpatine's rise to power, the Sith were legion. Lord Khan, Sith Master and founder of the Brotherhood of Darkness, strode through the gore of the battlefield, a tall shadow in the night's gloom. Thousands of Republic troops and nearly 100 Jedi had given their lives trying to defend this world against his army, and they'd lost. He relished their suffering and despair. Even now, he could sense it rising up like the stench from the broken corpses scattered about the valley. In the distance, a storm was brewing. As each flash of lightning illuminated the sky, Korriban's great Sith temple was momentarily visible in the distance, a stark silhouette towering over the barren horizon. A pair of figures waited in the center of the slaughter, one human and the other Twi'lek. He recognized them, despite the darkness, Cordis and Kopej, two of the more powerful Sith lords. Once they had been bitter rivals, but now they served together in Khan's brotherhood. He approached them quickly, smiling. Cordis, tall and so lean as to appear almost skeletal, smiled back.
This is a great victory, Lord Khan. It has been far too long since the Sith have had an academy on Korriban.
I sense you are eager to begin training the new apprentices here, Khan replied. I expect you will provide me with many more powerful and loyal Sith adepts and masters in the coming years.
Provide you?
Kopej asked pointedly.
Don't you mean provide us? Are we not all part of the Brotherhood of Darkness?
His question was met with an easy laugh. Of course, Kopej. A mere slip of the tongue.
Kopej refuses to celebrate in our triumph,
Cordis noted.
He has been like this all night.
Khan clasped a hand on the hefty Twi'lek's shoulder.
This is a great victory for us, he said.
Korriban is more than just another world. It is a symbol, the birthplace of the Sith. This victory sends a message to the Republic and the Jedi. Now, they will truly know and fear the Brotherhood.
Kopej shrugged free of Khan's hand and turned away, with a flick of the tips of the long leku wound around his neck.
Celebrate if you wish, he called over his shoulder as he walked away. But the real war has only just begun.
Part 1. 3 years later. Chapter 1.
Desol was lost in the suffering of his job, barely even aware of his surroundings. His arms ached from the endless pounding of the hydraulic jack. Small bits of rock skipped off the cavern wall as he bored through, ricocheting off his protective goggles and stinging his exposed face and hands. Clouds of atomized dust filled the air, obscuring his vision, and the screeching whine of the jack filled the cavern, drowning out all other sounds as it burrowed centimeter by agonizing centimeter into the thick vein of cortosis woven into the rock before him. Impervious to both heat and energy, cortosis was prized in the construction of armor and shielding by both commercial and military interests, especially with the galaxy at war. Highly resistant to blaster bolts, Cortosis alloys supposedly could withstand even the blade of a lightsaber. Unfortunately, the very properties that made it so valuable also made it extremely difficult to mine. Plasma torches were virtually useless. It would take days to burn away even a small section of Cortosis-laced rock. The only effective way to mine it was through the brute force of hydraulic jacks pounding relentlessly away at a vein, chipping the Cortosis free bit by bit. Cortosis was one of the hardest materials in the galaxy. The force of the pounding quickly wore down the head of a jack, blunting it until it became almost useless. The dust clogged the hydraulic pistons, making them jam. Mining Cortosis was hard on the equipment, and even harder on the miners. Dez had been hammering away for nearly 6 standard hours. The jack weighed more than 30 kilos, and the strain of keeping it raised and pressed against the rock face was taking its toll. His arms were trembling from the exertion. His lungs were gasping for air and choking on the clouds of fine mineral dust thrown up from the jack's head. Even his teeth hurt. The rattling vibration felt as if it were shaking them loose from his gums. But the miners on Apatros were paid based on how much Cortosis they brought back. If he quit now, another miner would jump in and start working the vein, taking a share of the profits. Dez didn't like to share. The whine of the jack's motor took on a higher pitch, becoming a keening wail Dez was all too familiar with. At 20,000 RPM, the motor sucked in dust like a thirsty bantha sucking up water after a long desert crossing. The only way to combat it was by regular cleaning and servicing, and the Outer Rim Ore Works Company preferred to buy cheap equipment and replace it, rather than sinking credits into maintenance. Dez knew exactly what was going to happen next, and a second later, it did. The motor blew. The hydraulic ceased with a horrible crunch and a cloud of black smoke spit out the rear of the jack. Cursing Oro and its corporate policies, Dez released his cramped finger from the trigger and tossed the spent piece of equipment to the floor. "Move aside, kid," a voice said. "Gerd." One of the other miners stepped up and tried to shoulder Dez out of the way so he could work the vein with his own jack. Gerd had been working the mines for nearly 20 standard years, and it had turned his body into a mass of hard, knotted muscle. But Dez had been working the mines for 10 years himself, ever since he was a teenager, and he was just as solid as the older man, and a little bigger. He didn't budge. "I'm not done here," he said. "Jack died, that's all. Hand me yours, and I'll keep at it for a while." "You know the rules, kid. You stop working and someone else is allowed to move in." Technically, Gerd was right, but nobody ever jumped another miner's claim over an equipment malfunction. Not unless he was trying to pick a fight. Dez took a quick look around. The chamber was empty, except for the two of them, standing less than half a meter apart. Not a surprise. Dez usually chose caverns far off the main tunnel network. It had to be more than mere coincidence that Gerd was here. Dez had known Gerd for as long as he could remember. The middle-aged man had been friends with Hurst, Dez's father, back when Dez first started working the mines at 13. He'd taken a lot of abuse from the bigger miners. His father had been the worst tormentor, but Gerd had been one of the main instigators, dishing out more than his fair share of teasing, insults, and the occasional cuff on the ear. Their harassments had ended shortly after Dez's father died of a massive heart attack. It wasn't because the miners felt sorry for the orphaned young man, though. By the time Hurst died, the tall, skinny teenager they loved to bully had become a mountain of muscle with heavy hands and a fierce temper. Mining was a tough job. It was the closest thing to hard labor outside a Republic prison colony. Whoever worked the mines on Apatros got big. And Dez just happened to become the biggest of them all. Half a dozen black eyes, countless bloody noses, and one broken jaw in the space of a month was all it took for Hurst's old friends to decide they'd be happier if they left Dez alone. Yet it was almost as if they blamed him for Hurst's death. And every few months, one of them tried again. Gerd had always been smart enough to keep his distance, until now.
I don't see any of your friends here with you, old man,
Dez said.
So back off my claim, and nobody gets hurt.
Gerd spat on the ground at Dez's feet.
You don't even know what day it is, do you, boy? Criffin disgrace is what you are!
They were standing close enough to each other that Dez could smell the sour Corellian whiskey on Gerd's breath. The man was drunk. Drunk enough to come looking for a fight, but still sober enough to hold his own.
5 years ago today,
Gerd said, shaking his head sadly.
5 years ago today, your own father died. And you don't even remember.
Dez rarely even thought about his father anymore. He hadn't been sorry to see him go. His earliest memories were of his father smacking him. He didn't even remember the reason. Hurst rarely needed one.
Can't say I miss Hurst the same way you do, Gerd.
Hurst?
Gerd snorted.
He raised you by himself after your mama died, and you don't even have the respect to call him dad? You ungrateful son of a cathound.
Dez glared down menacingly at Gerd, but the shorter man was too full of drink and self-righteous indignation to be intimidated.
Should have expected this from a mud-crutch whelp like you.
Gerd continued.
Hurst always said you were no good. He knew there was something wrong with you. Bane?
Dez narrowed his eyes, but didn't rise to the bait. Hurst had called him by that name when he was drunk.
Bane.
He'd blamed his son for his wife's death. Blamed him for being stuck on a Patros. He considered his only child to be the bane of his existence. A fact he'd tended to spit out at Dez in his drunken rages.
Bane.
It represented everything spiteful, petty, and mean about his father. It struck at the innermost fears of every child. Fear of disappointment, fear of abandonment, fear of violence. As a kid, that name had hurt more than all the smacks from his father's heavy fists. But Dez wasn't a kid anymore. Over time, he'd learned to ignore it, along with all the rest of the hateful bile that spilled from his father's mouth.
I don't have time for this, he muttered. I've got work to do.
With one hand, he grabbed the hydraulic jack from Gerd's grasp. He put the other hand on Gerd's shoulder and shoved him away. Stumbling back, the inebriated man caught his heel on a rock and fell roughly to the ground. He stood up with a snarl, his hands balling into fists.
Guess your daddy's been gone too long, boy! You need someone to beat the sense back into you!
Gerd was drunk, but he was no fool, Dez realized. Dez was bigger, stronger, younger. But he'd spent the last 6 hours working a hydraulic jack. He was covered in grime, and the sweat was dripping off his face. His shirt was drenched. Gerd's uniform, on the other hand, was still relatively clean. No dust, no sweat stains. He must have been planning this all day, taking it easy and sitting back while Dez wore himself out. But Dez wasn't about to back down from a fight. Throwing Gerd's jack to the ground, he dropped into a crouch, feet wide and arms held out in front of him. Gerd charged forward, swinging his right fist in a vicious uppercut. Dez reached out and caught the punch with the open palm of his left hand, absorbing the force of the blow. His right hand snapped forward and grabbed the underside of Gerd's right wrist. As he pulled the older man forward, Dez ducked down and turned, driving his shoulder into Gerd's chest. Using his opponent's own momentum against him, Dez straightened up and yanked hard on Gerd's wrist, flipping him up and over so that he crashed to the ground on his back. The fight should have ended right then. Dez had a split second where he could have dropped his knee onto his opponent, driving the breath from his lungs and pinning him to the ground while he pounded Gerd with his fists, but it didn't happen. His back, exhausted from hours of hefting the 30-kilo jack, spasmed. The pain was agonizing. Instinctively, Dez straightened up, clutching at the knotted lumbar muscles. It gave Gerd a chance to roll out of the way and get back to his feet. Somehow, Dez managed to drop into his fighting crouch again. His back howled in protest, and he grimaced as red-hot daggers of pain shot through his body. Gerd saw the grimace and laughed.
Cramping up there, boy? You should know better than to try and fight after a 6-hour shift in the mines.
Gerd charged forward again. This time his hands weren't fists, but claws, grasping and grabbing at anything they could find, trying to nullify the younger man's height and reach by getting in close. Dez tried to scramble out of the way, but his legs were too stiff and sore to get him clear. One hand grabbed his shirt, the other got hold of his belt, as Gerd pulled both of them to the ground. They grappled together, wrestling on the hard, uneven stone of the cavern floor. Gerd had his face buried against Dessel's chest to protect it, keeping Dez from landing a solid elbow or headbutt. He still had a grip on Dez's belt, but now his other hand was free and punching blindly up to where he guessed Dez's face would be. Dez was forced to wrap his arms in and around Gerd's own, interlocking them so neither man could throw a punch. With their limbs pinned, strategy and technique meant little. The fight had become a test of strength and endurance, with the two combatants slowly wearing each other down. Dessel tried to roll Gerd over onto his back, but his weary body betrayed him. His limbs were heavy and soft. He couldn't get the leverage he needed. Instead, it was Gerd who was able to twist and turn, wrenching one of his hands free while still keeping his face pressed tight against Dez's chest so it wouldn't be exposed. Dez wasn't so lucky. His face was open and vulnerable. Gerd struck a blow with his free hand, but he didn't hit with a closed fist. Instead, he drove his thumb hard into Dez's cheek, only a few centimeters from his real target. He struck again with the thumb, looking to gouge out one of his opponent's eyes and leave him blind and writhing in pain. It took Dez a second to realize what was happening. His tired mind had become as slow and clumsy as his body. He turned his face away just as the second blow landed, the thumb jamming painfully into the cartilage of his upper ear. Dark rage exploded inside Dez, a burst of fiery passion that burned away the exhaustion and fatigue. Suddenly, his mind was clear, and his body felt strong and rejuvenated. He knew what he was going to do next. More importantly, he knew with absolute certainty what Gerd would do next too. He couldn't explain how he knew. Sometimes he could just anticipate an opponent's next move. Instinct, some might have said. Dez felt it was something more. It was too detailed, too specific to be simple instinct. It was more like a vision, a brief glimpse into the future. And whenever it happened, Dez always knew what to do, as if something was guiding and directing his actions. When the next blow came, Dez was more than ready for it. He could picture it perfectly in his mind. He knew exactly when it was coming and precisely where it would strike. This time, he turned his head in the opposite direction, exposing his face to the incoming blow and opening his mouth. He bit down hard, his timing perfect, and his teeth sank deep into the dirty flesh of Gerd's probing thumb. Gerd screamed as Dez clamped his jaw shut, severing the tendons and striking bone. He wondered if he could bite clean through, and then, as if the very thought made it happen, he severed Gerd's thumb. The screams became shrieks as Gerd released his grasp and rolled away, clasping his maimed hand with his whole one. Crimson blood welled up through the fingers trying to staunch the flow from his stump. Standing up slowly, Dez spat the thumb out onto the ground. The taste of blood was hot in his mouth. His body felt strong and re-energized, as if some great power surged through his veins. All the fight had been taken out of his opponent. Dez could do anything he wanted to Gerd now. The older man rolled back and forth on the floor, his hand clutched to his chest. He was moaning and sobbing, begging for mercy, pleading for help. Dez shook his head in disgust. Gerd had brought this on himself. It had started as a simple fist fight. The loser would have ended up with a black eye and some bruises, but nothing more. Then the older man had taken things to another level by trying to blind him, and he'd responded in kind. Dez had learned long ago not to escalate a fight unless he was willing to pay the price of losing. Now Gerd had learned that lesson, too. Dez had a temper, but he wasn't the kind to keep beating on a helpless opponent. Without looking back at his defeated foe, he left the cavern and headed back up the tunnel to tell one of the foremen what had happened so someone could tend to Gerd's injury. He wasn't worried about the consequences. The medics could reattach Gerd's thumb, so at worst, Dez would be fined a day or two's wages. The corporation didn't really care what its employees did, as long as they kept coming back to mine the cortosis. Fights were common among the miners, and Oro almost always turned a blind eye. Though this particular fight had been more vicious than most, savage and short with a brutal end. Just like life on a Patros.
Chapter 2.
Sitting in the back of the land cruiser used to transport miners between Apatros' only colony and the mines, Dez felt exhausted. All he wanted was to get back to his bunk in the barracks and sleep. The adrenaline had drained out of him, leaving him hyper-aware of the stiffness and soreness of his body. He slumped down in his seat and gazed around the interior of the cruiser. Normally there would have been 20 other miners crammed into the speeder with him, but this one was empty, except for him and the pilot. After the fight with Gerd, the foreman had suspended Dez without pay, effective immediately, and had ordered the transport to take him back to the colony. "This kind of thing is getting old, Dez," the foreman had said with a frown. "We've got to make an example of you this time. You can't work the mines until Gerd is healed up and back on the job." What he really meant was, you can't earn any credits until Gerd comes back. He'd still be charged room and board, of course. Every day that he sat around doing nothing would go onto his tab, adding to the debt he was working so desperately to pay off. Dez figured it would be 4 or 5 days until Gerd was able to handle a hydraulic jack again. The on-site medic had reattached the severed thumb using a vibroscalpel and synth flesh. A few days of colto injections and some cheap meds to dull the pain, and Gerd would be back at it. Bacta therapy could have him back in a day, but Bacta was expensive, and Oro wouldn't spring for it unless Gerd had miner's insurance, which Dez highly doubted. Most miners never bothered with the company-sponsored insurance program. It was expensive, for one thing. What with room, board, and the fees covering the cost of transport to and from the mines, most thought they gave Oro more than enough of their hard-earned pay, without adding insurance premiums onto the stack. It wasn't just the cost, though. It was almost as if the men and women who worked the Cortosis mines were in denial, refusing to admit the potential dangers and hazards they encountered every day. Getting insurance would force them to take a look at the cold, hard facts. Few miners ever reached their golden years. The tunnels claimed many, burying bodies in cave-ins or incinerating them when somebody tapped into a pocket of explosive gases trapped in the rock. Even those who made it out of the mines tended not to survive long into their retirement. The mines took their toll. 60-year-old men were left with bodies that looked and felt like they were 90. Broken shells, worn down by decades of hard physical labor and exposure to airborne contaminants that slipped through the substandard Oro filters. When Dez's father died, with no insurance, of course, all Dez got out of it was the privilege of taking on his father's accumulated debt. Hurst had spent more time drinking and gambling than mining. To pay for his monthly room and board, he'd often had to borrow credits from Oro at an interest rate that would be criminal anywhere but in the Outer Rim. The debt kept piling up, month to month and year to year, but Hurst didn't seem to care. He was a single parent with a son he resented, trapped in a brutal job he despised. He'd given up any hope of escaping Apatros long before the heart attack claimed him. The hut spawn probably would have been glad to know his son had gotten stuck with his bill. The transport sped above the barren rocks of the small planet's flatlands with no sound but the endless drone of the engines. The featureless wastes flew by in a blur, until the view out the window was nothing but a curtain of shapeless gray. The effect was hypnotic. Dez could feel his tired mind and body eager to drift into deep and dreamless sleep. This was how they got you. Work you to exhaustion, dull your senses, numb your will into submission. Until you accepted your lot and wasted your entire life in the grit and grime of the Cortosis mines. All in the relentless service of the Outer Rim Ore Works Company. It was a surprisingly effective trap. It worked on men like Gerd and Hurst, but it wasn't going to work on Dez. Even with his father's crushing debt, Dez knew he'd pay Oro off someday and leave this life behind. He was destined for something greater than this small, insignificant existence. He knew this with absolute certainty, and it was this knowledge that gave him the strength to carry on in the face of the relentless, sometimes hopeless grind. It gave him the strength to fight, even when part of him felt like giving up. He was suspended, unable to work the mines, but there were other ways to earn credits. With a great effort, he forced himself to stand up. The floor swayed under his feet as the speeder made constant adjustments to maintain its programmed cruising altitude of half a meter above ground level. He took a second to get used to the rolling rhythm of the transport, then half-walked, half-staggered up the aisle between the seats to the pilot at the front. He didn't recognize the man, but they all tended to look the same anyway. Grim, unsmiling features, dull eyes, and always wearing an expression as if they were on the verge of a blinding headache.
"Hey,"
Dez said, trying to sound nonchalant.
"Any ships come into the spaceport today?"
There was no reason for the pilot to keep his attention fixed on the path ahead. The 40-minute trip between the mines and the colony was a straight line across an empty plain. Some of the pilots even stole naps along the route. Yet this one refused to turn and look at Dez as he answered.
"Cargo ship touched down a few hours ago," he said in a bored voice. "Military, Republic cargo ship." Dez smiled.
"They're staying for a while?"
The pilot didn't answer. He only snorted and shook his head at the stupidity of the question. Dez nodded and stumbled back toward his seat at the rear of the transport. He knew the answer, too. Cortosis was used in the hulls of everything, from fighters to capital ships, as well as being woven into the body armor of the troops. And as the war against the Sith dragged on, the Republic's need for Cortosis kept increasing. Every few weeks, a Republic freighter would touch down on a Patros. The next day, it would leave again, its cargo base filled with the valuable mineral. Until then, the crew, officers and enlisted soldiers alike, would have nothing to do but wait. From past experience, Dez knew that whenever Republic soldiers had a few hours to kill, they liked to play cards. And wherever people played cards, there was money to be made. Lowering himself back onto his seat at the rear of the speeder, Dez decided that maybe he wasn't quite ready to hit his bunk after all. By the time the transport stopped on the edges of the colony, Dez's body was tingling with anticipation. He hopped out and sauntered toward his barracks at a leisurely pace, fighting his own eagerness and the urge to run. Even now, he imagined, the Republic soldiers and their credits would be sitting at the gaming tables in the colony's only cantina. Still, there was no point in rushing over there. It was late afternoon, the sun just beginning its descent beyond the horizon to the north. By now, most of the miners from the night shift would be awake. Many of them would already be at the cantina, whiling away the time until they had to make the journey out to the mines to start their shift. For the next 2 hours, Dez knew he'd be lucky to find a place to sit down in the cantina, never mind finding an empty seat at a Pazok or Savak table. Meanwhile, it would be another few hours before the men working the day shift climbed onto the waiting transport to head back to their homes. He'd get to the cantina long before any of them. Back at his barracks, he stripped off his grime-stained coveralls and climbed into the deserted communal showers, scouring the sweat and fine rock dust from his body. Then he changed into some clean clothes and sauntered out into the street, making his way slowly toward the cantina on the far side of town. The cantina didn't have a name. It didn't need one. Nobody ever had any trouble finding it. The Patros was a small world, barely more than a moon with an atmosphere and some indigenous plant life. There were precious few places to go. The mines, the colony, or the barren wastes in between. The mines were a massive complex encompassing the caves and tunnels dug by Oro, as well as the refining and processing branches of Oro's operations. The spaceports were located there, too. Freighters left daily with shipments of Cortosis bound for some wealthier world closer to Coruscant and the Galactic Core. And incoming vessels bringing equipment and supplies to keep the mines running arrived every other day. Employees who weren't strong enough to mine Cortosis worked in the refining plants or the spaceport. The pay wasn't as good, but they tended to live longer. But no matter where people worked, they all came home to the same place at the end of their shifts. The colony was nothing more than a ramshackle town of temporary barracks thrown together by Oro to house the few hundred workers expected to keep the mines running. Like the world itself, the colony was officially known as Apatros. To those who lived there, it was more commonly referred to as the Muck Huts. Every building was the same shade of dingy gray durasteel, the exterior weathered and worn. The insides of the buildings were virtually identical, temporary workers' barracks that had become all too permanent. Each structure housed four small private rooms meant for two people, but often holding three or more. Sometimes, entire families shared one of those rooms, unless they could find the credits for the outrageous rents Oro charged for more space. Each room had bunks built into the walls and a single door that opened onto a narrow hall. A communal bathroom and shower were located at the end. The doors tended to squeak on ill-fitting hinges that were never tended to. The roofs were a patchwork of quick fixes to seal up the leaks that inevitably sprang whenever it rained. Broken windows were taped against the wind and cold, but never replaced. A thin layer of dust accumulated over everything, but few of the residents ever bothered to sweep out their domiciles. The entire colony was less than a kilometer on each square side, making it possible to walk from any given building to any of the other identical structures in less than 20 standard minutes. Despite the unrelenting similarity of the architecture, navigating the colony was easy. The barracks had been placed in straight rows and columns, forming a grid of utilitarian streets between the uniformly spaced domiciles. The streets couldn't exactly be called clean, though they were hardly festering with garbage. Oro cleared trash and refuse just often enough to keep conditions sanitary, since an outbreak of diseases bred by filth would adversely affect the mine's production. However, the company didn't seem to mind the cluttered junk that inevitably accumulated throughout the town. Broken down generators, rusted out machinery, corroded scraps of metal and discarded worn out tools crowded the narrow streets between the barracks. There were only two structures in the colony that were in any way distinguished from the rest. One was the Oro Market, the only store on world. It had once been a barracks, but the bunks had been replaced with shelves, and the communal shower area was now a secure storage room. A small black and white sign had been fastened to the wall outside, listing the hours of operation. There were no displays to lure shoppers in and no advertising. The market stocked only the most basic items, all at scandalous markups. Credit was gladly advanced against future wages at Oro's typically high interest rate, guaranteeing that buyers would spend even more hours in the mine working off their purchases. The other dissimilar building was the Cantina itself, a magnificent triumph of beauty and design, when compared with the dismal homogeny of the rest of the colony. The cantina was built a few hundred meters beyond the edge of the town, set well apart from the gray grid of barracks. It stood only three stories high. But because every other structure was limited to a single floor, it dominated the landscape. Not that it needed to be that tall. Inside the cantina, everything was located on the ground floor. The upper stories were merely a facade constructed for show by Groshik, the Nymoidian owner and bartender. Above the first floor ceiling, the second and third floors didn't really exist. There were only the rising walls and a dome made of tinted violet glass, illuminated from within. Matching violet lights covered the pale blue exterior walls. On almost any world, the effect would have been ostentatious and tacky. But amid the gray of Apatros, it was doubly so. Groshik often proclaimed that he had intentionally made his cantina as garish as possible, simply to offend the Oro powers that be. The sentiment made him popular with the miners, but Dez doubted if Oro really cared one way or the other. Grosha could paint his cantina any color he wanted, as long as he gave the corporation its cut of the profits each week. The 20 standard hour day of Apatros was split evenly between the two shifts of miners. Dez and the rest of the early crew worked from 0800 to 1800. His counterparts worked from 1800 to 0800. Groshik, in an effort to maximize profits, opened each afternoon at 1300 and didn't close for 10 straight hours. This allowed him to serve the night crew workers before they started and catch the day crew when that shift was over. He'd close at 0300, clean for 2 hours, sleep for 6, then get up at 1100 and start the process all over again. His routine was well known to all the miners. The Nymoidian was as regular as the rising and setting of Apatros's pale orange sun. As Dez crossed the distance between the edge of the colony proper and the cantina's welcoming door, he could already hear the sounds coming from inside. Loud music, laughter, chatter, clinking glasses. It was almost 1600 now. The day shift had 2 hours to go before quitting time, but the cantina was still packed with night shift workers looking to have a drink or something to eat before they boarded the shuttles that would take them to the mines. Dez didn't recognize any faces. The day and night crews rarely crossed paths. The patrons were mostly humans, with a few Twi'leks, Sullustans, and Saurians filling out the crowd. Dez was surprised to notice a Rhodian, too. Apparently the night crew were more tolerant of other species than the day shift. There were no waitresses, servers, or dancers. The only employee in the cantina was Groshik himself. Anyone who wanted a drink had to come up to the large bar built into the back wall and order it. Dez pushed his way through the crowd. Groshik saw him coming and momentarily dipped out of sight behind the bar, reappearing with a mug of geyser ale just as Dez reached the counter.
"You're here early today,"
Groshik said as he set the drink down with a heavy thud. His low, gravelly voice was difficult to hear above the din of the crowd. His words always had a guttural quality, as if he were speaking from the very back of his throat. The Nymoidian liked him, though Dez wasn't sure why. Maybe it was because he'd watched Dez grow up from a young kid to a man. Maybe he'd just felt sorry Dez had been stuck with such a rank weed for a father. Whatever the reason, there was a standing arrangement between the two. Dez never had to pay for a drink if it was poured without being asked for. Dez gratefully accepted the gift and downed it in one long draft, then slammed the empty mug back down onto the table.
"Ran into a bit of trouble with Gerd," he replied, wiping his mouth. "I bit his thumb off, so they let me go home early."
Groshik tilted his head to one side and fixed his enormous red eyes on Dez. The sour expression on his amphibian-like face didn't change, but his body shook ever so slightly. Dez knew him well enough to realize the Nymoidian was laughing.
"Seems like a fair trade,"
Groshik croaked, refilling the mug. Dez didn't guzzle the second drink as he had the first. Groshik rarely gave him more than one on the house, and he didn't want to abuse the bartender's generosity. He turned his attention to the crowd. The Republic visitors were easy to spot. 4 humans, 2 men, 2 women, and a male Ithorian in crisp navy uniforms. It wasn't just their clothes that made them stand out, though. They all stood straight and tall, whereas most of the miners tended to hunch forward, as if carrying a great weight on their backs. On one side of the main room, a smaller section was roped off from the rest of the cantina. It was the only part of the place Groshik had nothing to do with. The Oro Company allowed gambling on Apatros, but only if it was in charge of the tables. Officially, this was to keep anyone from cheating, but everyone knew Oro's real concern was keeping the wagers in check. It didn't want one of its employees to win big and pay off all his or her debts in one lucky night. By keeping the maximum limits low, Oro made sure it was more profitable to work the mines than the tables. In the gaming section were 4 more naval soldiers wearing the uniform of the Republic Fleet, along with a dozen or so miners. A Twi'lek woman with the rank of petty officer on her lapel was playing Pezak. A young ensign was sitting at the sabacc table, talking loudly to everyone around him, though nobody seemed to be listening to him. Two more officers, both human, one male, one female, also sat at the Sabacc table. The woman was a lieutenant. The man bore the insignia of a full commander. Daz assumed they were the senior officers in charge of the mission to receive the Cortosa shipment.
"I see you've noticed our recruiters," Roshik muttered.
The war against the Sith, officially nothing more than a series of protracted military engagements, even though the whole galaxy knew it was a war, required a steady stream of young and eager cadets for the front lines. And for some reason, the Republic always expected the citizens on the Outer Rim worlds to jump at the chance to join them. Whenever a Republic military crew passed through Apatros, the officers tried to round up new recruits. They'd buy a round of drinks, then use it as an excuse to start up a conversation, usually about the glorious and heroic life of being a soldier. Sometimes they'd play up the brutality of the Sith. Other times they'd spin promises of a better life in the Republic military, all the while pretending to be friendly and sympathetic to the locals, hoping a few would join their cause. Dez suspected they received some kind of bonus for any new recruit they conned into signing up. Unfortunately for them, they weren't going to find too many takers on Apatros. The Republic wasn't too popular on the Rim. People here, including Dez, knew the core worlds exploited small remote planets like Apatros for their own gain. The Sith found a lot of anti-Republic sympathizers out here on the fringes of civilized space. That was one of the reasons their numbers kept growing as the war dragged on. Despite their dissatisfaction with the core worlds, people still might have signed up with the recruiters if the Republic wasn't so concerned with following the absolute letter of the law. Anyone hoping to escape Apatros and the clutches of the mining corporation was in for a rude shock. Debts to Oro still had to be paid, even by recruits protecting the galaxy against the rising Sith threat. If someone owed money to a legitimate corporation, the Republic fleet would garnish his or her wages until those debts were paid. Not too many miners were excited about the prospect of joining a war, only to have the privilege of not getting paid. Some of the miners resented the senior officers and their constant push to lure naive young men and women into joining their cause. It didn't bother Dez, though. He'd listen to them prattle on all night, as long as they kept playing cards. He figured it was a small price to pay for getting his hands on their credits. His eagerness must have shown, at least to Groshek.
"Any chance you heard a Republic crew was stopping by and then picked a fight with GERD, just so you could get here early?"
Dez shook his head.
"No, just a happy coincidence is all. What angle are they working this time? Glory of the Republic? Trying to warn us about the horrors of the Brotherhood of Darkness,"
was the carefully neutral reply.
"Not going over too well."
The cantina owner kept his real opinions to himself when it came to matters of politics. His customers were free to talk about any subject they wanted, but no matter how heated their arguments became, he always refused to take sides.
"Bad for business," he'd explained once. "Agree with someone and they'll be your friend for the rest of the night. Cross them and they might hate you for weeks."
Nymordians were known for their shrewd business sense, and Groshek was no exception. A miner pushed his way up to the bar and demanded a drink. When Groshek went to fill the order, Dez turned to study the gaming area. There weren't any free seats at the Sabacc table, so for the time being, he was forced into the role of spectator. For well over an hour, he studied the plays and the wagers of the newcomers, paying particular attention to the senior officers. They tended to be better players than the enlisted troops, probably because they had more credits to lose. The game on Apatros followed a modified version of the Bespin standard rules. The basics of the game were simple. Make a hand as close to 23 as possible without going over. Each round, a player had to either bet to stay in the hand or fold. Any player who chose to stay in could draw a new card, discard a card, or place a card into the interference field to lock in its value. At the end of any round, a player could come up, revealing his or her hand, and forcing all other players to show their cards as well. Best hand at the table won the hand pot.
Any score over 23 or below negative 23 was a bomb out that required the player to pay a penalty. And if a player had a hand that totaled exactly 23, a pure sabacc, he or she won the sabacc pot as a bonus. But what with random shifts that could unexpectedly change the value of cards from round to round, and other players coming up early, a pure sabacc was a lot harder to achieve than it sounded. Sabacc was more than a game of luck. It was about strategy and style, knowing when to bluff and when to back down, knowing how to adapt to the ever-changing cards. Some players were too cautious, never betting more than the minimum raise, even when they had a good hand. Others were too aggressive, trying to bully the rest of the table with outrageous bets, even when they had nothing. A player's natural tendencies showed through if you knew what to look for. The ensign, for example, was clearly new to the game. He kept staying in with weak hands instead of folding his cards. He was a chaser, not satisfied with cards good enough to collect the hand pot. He was always looking for the perfect hand, hoping to win big and collect the sabacc pot that kept on growing until it was won. As a result, he kept getting caught with bomb-out hands and having to pay a penalty. It didn't seem to slow his betting, though. He was one of those players with more credits than sense, which suited Dez just fine. To be an expert sabacc player, you had to know how to control the table. It didn't take Dez many hands to realize the Republic commander was doing just that. He knew how to bet big and make other players fold winning hands. He knew when to bet small to lure others into playing hands they should have folded. He didn't worry much about his own cards. He knew that the secret to sabacc was figuring out what everyone else was holding and then letting them think they knew what cards he was holding. It was only when all the hands were revealed and he was raking in the chips that his opponents would realize how wrong they'd been. He was good, Dez had to admit, better than most of the Republic players who passed through. Despite his pleasant appearance, he was ruthless in scooping up pot after pot. But Dez had a good feeling. Sometimes he just knew he couldn't lose. He was going to win tonight, and win big. There was a groan from one of the miners at the table.
"Another round and that sabacc pot was mine," he said, shaking his head. "You're lucky you came up when you did," he added, speaking to the commander.
Dez knew it wasn't luck. The miner had been so excited he was twitching in his seat. Anyone with half a brain could see he was working toward a powerful hand. The commander had seen it and made his move, cutting the hand short and chopping the other gambler's hopes off at the knees.
"That's it," the miner said, pushing away from the table. "I'm tapped out."
"Looks like now is your chance,"
Groshek whispered under his breath as he swept past to pour another drink.
"Good luck."
"I don't need luck tonight," Dez thought. He crossed the floor of the cantina and stepped over the nano-silk rope into the auro-controlled gaming room.
Chapter 3.
Dez approached the sabacc table and nodded to the Beta 4 card shark dealing out the hands. Oro preferred automated droids to organic dealers. No salary to pay, and there was no chance a wily gambler could convince a droid to cheat.
"I'm in,"
he declared, taking the empty seat. The ensign was sitting directly across from him. He let out a long, loud whistle.
"Woo! Blast! You're a big boy!"
he shouted boisterously.
"How tall are you? 190, 195?
2 meters even,"
Dez replied without looking at him. He swiped his Aura account card through the reader built into the table and punched in his security code. The buy-in for the table was added to the total already owing on his Aura account, and the card shark obediently pushed a stack of chips across the table toward him.
"Good luck, sir."
The ensign continued to size Dez up, taking another long drink from his mug. Then he brayed out a laugh.
"Wow, they grow you fellas big out here on the rim. You sure you ain't really a Wookiee somebody shaved for a joke?"
A few of the other players laughed, but quickly stopped when they saw Dez clench his jaw. The man smelled of Corellian ale, same as Gerd had when he'd picked a fight with Dez just a few hours earlier. Dez's muscles tightened and he leaned forward in his chair. The smaller man let out a short, nervous breath.
"Come on now, son,"
the commander said to Dez in a calming voice, stepping in to control the situation the same way he'd been controlling the table all game long. He had an air of quiet authority, a patriarch presiding over a family squabble at the dinner table.
"It's just a joke. Can't you take a joke?"
Turning to face the only player at the table good enough to give him a real challenge, Dez flashed a grin and let the tension slip from his coiled muscles.
"Sure, I can take a joke, but I'd rather take your credits."
There was a brief pause, and then it was as if everyone had sighed in relief. The officer chuckled and returned the smile.
"Fair enough, let's play some cards."
Dez started slow, playing conservatively and folding often. The limits on the table were low. The maximum value of any given hand was capped at 100 credits. Between the 5-credit ante and the 2-credit administration fee, Oro charged players each time they started a new round, the hand pots would barely cover the cost of sitting down at the table, even for a solid player. The trick was to win just enough hand pots to be able to stick around long enough for a chance at the sabacc pot that continued to build with each hand. When he first started playing, one of the soldiers tried to make small talk.
"I noticed most of the human miners here shaved their heads," he said, nodding out at the crowd. "Why is that?"
"We don't shave. Our hair falls out,"
Dez replied.
"Comes from working too many shifts in the mines."
"Working the mines? I don't get it."
"The filters don't remove all the impurities from the air. You work 10-hour shifts day in and day out, and the contaminants build up in your system."
He spoke in a flat, neutral voice. There was no bitterness. For him and the rest of the miners, it was just a fact of life.
"It has side effects. We get sick a lot. Our hair falls out. We're supposed to take a few days off now and again, but ever since Oro signed those Republic military contracts, the mines never shut down. Basically, we're being slowly poisoned to make sure your cargo hold is full when you leave."
That was enough to kill any other attempts at conversation, and they continued the hands in relative silence. After half an hour, Dez was about even for the night, but he was just getting warmed up. He pushed in his ante and the Oro cut, as did the other 7 players at the table. The dealer flipped 2 cards out to each of them and another hand began. The first 2 players peeked at their cards and folded. The Republic ensign glanced at his cards and threw in enough chips to stay in the hand. Dez wasn't surprised. He hardly ever folded his cards, even when he had nothing. The ensign quickly pushed one of his cards into the interference field. Each turn, a player could move one of the electronic chip cards into the interference field, locking in its value to protect it from changing if there was a shift at the end of the round. Dez shook his head. Locking in cards was a fool's play. You couldn't discard a locked-in card. Dez usually preferred to keep all his options open. The ensign, however, was thinking in the short term, not planning ahead. That probably explained why he was down several 100 credits on the night. Glancing at his own hand, Dez chose to stay in. All the rest of the players dropped, leaving just the 2 of them. The card shark dealt out another round of cards. Dez glanced down and saw he'd drawn Endurance, a face card with a value of -8. He was sitting at a total of 6, an incredibly weak hand. The smart move was to fold. Unless there was a shift, he was dead. But Dez knew there was going to be a shift. He knew it as surely as he'd known where and when Gerd's thumb was going to be when he bit down on it. These brief glimpses into the future didn't happen often, but when they did, he knew enough to listen to them. He pushed in his credits. The ensign matched the bet. The droid scooped the chips to the center of the table, and the marker in front of him began to pulse with rapidly changing colors. Blue meant no shift. All the cards would stay the same. Red meant a shift. An impulse would be sent out from the marker, and 1 electronic card from each player would randomly reset and change its value. The marker flickered back and forth between red and blue, gaining speed, until it was pulsing so quickly the colors blurred into a single violet hue. Then the flashing began to slow down, and it became possible to tell the individual colors apart again. Blue, red, blue, red, blue. It stopped on red.
Blast! The ensign swore. It always shifts when I have a good hand.
Des knew that wasn't true. The chances of shifting were 50-50, completely random. There was no way to predict whether a shift was coming unless you had a gift like Des occasionally did. The cards flickered as they reset, and Des scooped up his hand one more time. Endurance was gone, replaced by a 7. He was sitting at 21. Not a sabacc, but a solid hand. Before the next round could begin, Des flipped his cards over, exposing his hand to the table.
Coming up on 21, he said.
The ensign threw his cards to the table in disgust.
Blasted bomb out.
Des collected the small stack of chips that were the hand pot, while the other man grudgingly paid his penalty into the sabacc pot. Des guessed it was closing in on 500 credits by now. One of the miners at the table stood up.
Come on, we gotta go, he said. Last speeder leaves in 20 minutes.
With grumbles and complaints, the other miners got up from their seats and trudged off to start their shift. The ensign watched them go, then turned curiously to Des.
You ain't going with them, big fella? I thought you were complaining about never getting a day off earlier.
I'll work the day shift, Des said shortly. Those guys are the night shift.
Where's the rest of your crew? The lieutenant asked. Des clearly recognized her interest as an attempt to keep the ensign from saying something to further antagonize the big miner. The crowd's become awfully thin. She waved her hand around at the cantina, now virtually empty except for the Republic naval soldiers. Seeing the open seats at the sabacc table, a few of them were wandering over to join their comrades in the game.
They'll be along soon enough, Des said. I just ended my shift a bit early today.
Really?
Her tone implied that she knew of only one reason a miner's shift might end early.
Lieutenant,
one of the newly arrived soldiers said politely as they reached the table.
Commander,
he added, addressing the other officer.
Mind if we join in, sir?
The commander looked over at Des.
I don't want this young man to think the Republic is ganging up on him. If we take all the seats, where are his friends going to sit when they show up? He says they'll be along any minute.
They're not here now, Des said, and they're not my friends. You might as well sit down.
He didn't add that most of the day shift miners probably wouldn't play anyway. When Des showed up at the table, they tended to call it a night. He won too often for their liking. The empty seats were quickly filled up.
So how are the cards treating you, Ensign?
A young woman asked the man Des had bested in the last hand. She sat down beside him and placed a full mug of Corellian ale on the table in front of him.
Not so good,
he admitted, flashing a grin and exchanging his empty mug for the full one.
I might have to owe you for this drink. I can't seem to catch a break tonight.
He nodded his head in Dez's direction.
Watch out for this one. He's as good as the commander. Either that or he cheats.
He smiled quickly to show it was just another of his mildly offensive jokes. Des ignored him. It wasn't the first time he'd been called a cheat. He was aware that his precognition gave him an advantage over the other players. Maybe it was an unfair advantage, but he didn't consider it cheating. It wasn't as if he knew what was going to happen on every hand. He couldn't control it. He was just smart enough to make the most of it when it happened. The card shark began passing out chips to the newcomers, wishing each of them a perfunctory good luck as it did so. So it seems you don't really get on well with the other miners, the lieutenant said, keying on Des's earlier comments. Have you ever thought about changing careers? Des groaned inwardly. By the time he had joined the table, the officers had given up their recruiting spiel and stuck mostly to playing cards. Now he'd given her an opening to bring it up again.
I'm not interested in becoming a soldier, he said,
anting up for the next hand.
Don't be so hasty,
she said, her voice slipping into a soothing, gentle patter. Being a soldier for the Republic has its rewards.
I suspect it's better than working the mines, at least.
There's a whole galaxy out there, son. The commander added. World's a lot more attractive than this one, if you don't mind me saying.
Don't I know it?
Des thought.
Out loud, he said, I don't plan to spend my whole life here. But when I